Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. This is Allison Rose Levy, and I'm with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and your total health environment. I've been a health, food, and environmental reporter for a couple of decades. We talk about policy, society, media, science, all the different things that make up the total environment in which we live, thrive, are healthy, or maybe not so much, depending upon how things are going in the larger world around us. And every week on Connect the Dots, I talk with thought leaders, authors, analysts, experts, scientists, journalists, and advocates about different facets of the world that we live in that impact our health. And I use health also in a fairly broad way to include both mental and physical health. I also report on the Huffington Post, on Alternet, and on EcoWatch, as well as more information in my blogs can be found on my website, healthjournalistblog.com. This week, we have returning to Connect the Dots someone who has been on the show before and is one of my very favorite guests, and actually a core person to my whole outlook on how our world is functioning, and that is because he is a leading expert on media and communications, the very field through which we have shows like Connect the Dots, and really the context for my own long media career. So it's one thing to have the media kind of going on and sort of coming at us, and it's another thing to really have an understanding and analysis of the framework for the media that we access and receive, and that's what we're going to get today. I'm so happy to say, and Connect the Dots through talking with Robert McChesney, who is a leading media analyst and interpreter, and the author of a new book, Digital Disconnect. We'll be talking more about that in the course of the show. But first, I'd like to welcome Bob. He is a professor at the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's the author of many books, some of which we have featured on this show, including his more recent book before this one, a prior book to this one, with The Last Reporter, Please Turn Out the Lights. He's also a co-founder with John Nichols of the Free Press and a whole media reform campaign to really not just kind of moan and groan and wring our hands about the media, but to really change the media and to put media, journalism, news, the tools for democracy on a better footing. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Bob.
My pleasure, Allison.
I have been just devouring your new book. It is so terrific and fascinating. And I have to say that Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy, breaks a lot of myths with a lot of concrete analysis and facts. I was taking it on a recent plane ride to visit an Internet startup, who shall be nameless, really noble effort, I would have to say, in every way. And at one point, as we were having our discussions, I actually removed your book from my purse and sort of showed it, and people gasped and almost jumped back in horror. it seems it has magical powers. Let's talk a little bit to begin with about your subtitle, which is very provocative, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. This flies into the face of the progressive great hope that the media will really, you know, the internet will really be the way that we can finally sail past some of the constraining infrastructures of our society to a new world of unity and collective strength. And that's a dearly held belief by many, many people. I hear that from people all the time. Tell our listeners your view of that myth.
You know, I hear that too all the time, and I think probably there's a part of me that hopes that's true. It would be great if technologies had magical power that could help us leapfrog social institutions and powerful political and economic and military interests. You know, I don't think the internet is incapable of being a revolutionary or transformative technology. But I do think it can't do that unless we make it do that. I think that the policies we institute are going to shape to a large extent what sort of internet we get. And what I argue in the book is that the great promise of the internet has been altered phenomenally by policies which allow the internet to become basically a plaything for Wall Street and Madison Avenue and corporate America. And these policies have allowed the internet to become commercialized, to become a location for monopoly power, for surreptitious spying on citizens, for a variety of practices which are inimical to democracy in any way we understand it. And that people who think this technology is going to magically ride roughshod over powerful institutions, I think are dreaming. I don't think there's any evidence to say that will happen. Instead, I think it's more likely that powerful institutions seem to be incorporating the internet into their systems.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, the dream was that the internet eats them, and the reality that you're seeing and other analysts and scholars like yourself are really documenting and looking into is that these larger superstructures are in fact eating the internet and incorporating it. What can you give a few clear examples of how that's happening in ways that might be out in full public view, but no one is paying attention to, or you know,
sure,
they're just part of the landscape?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ways we could look at this, but just start, for example, with just the promise the internet had only 20 years ago. Just the World Wide Web was coming on, and it was beginning to be a ubiquitous medium. And already 20 years ago, I think, you know, it was pretty clear that the internet was about to vault onto the scene and change the world as we know it. And at that time, the idea of the internet was that it was going to give people immense amounts of information and power and control over their environment. And it was going to make it very difficult for tyrannical governments, big corporations, propagandists of all stripes to continue to dominate societies as they had in the United States or anywhere else for that matter. And, you know, if for the economy specifically, one of the great claims of the internet at that time, and you still hear it amazingly enough today, is that it was going to be this engine of competition, that consumers would have such a wealth of information online, they no longer could be silly putty for big corporate giants to pay the prices for inferior products. They could go find better prices for better products online and create competition. And then plucky entrepreneurs could come along, and they would see this, and they would start businesses to serve these consumers. And the big giant dinosaur company, manufacturing company or bank or whatever, would either get with the program or more likely go out of business. And, you know, what we see in online has been exactly the opposite of what the promise of the internet was in terms of the economy. Everywhere you turn online now, the dominant economic powers, Allison, are what economists call monopolies. And I don't mean monopoly in the sense you think of it where one person has sells the entirety of a market, where all the automobiles are sold by one company. We've never had monopolies like that. Even John D. Rockefeller with Standard Oil, the sort of legendary monopoly of American history, even in his prime, I don't think he had more than 80-85% of the market in the country. When economists use the term monopoly, they mean a company that has such an enormous amount of market share that it basically controls its fate. And it can use the pricing power it has to determine who else is allowed into the market. And it's usually not in their interest to get rid of everyone. So if they get 70-90% of the market, that's fine with them. They can let some small fry hang around on the edges because they can keep the price higher that way. So at any rate, if you look at the economy of the internet today, what do we find? What we find that is at every turn, the dominant companies are monopolies in the same sense that John D. Rockefeller was a monopoly with Standard Oil. We're talking about Google, Microsoft, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, eBay, Twitter, and you can toss in AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast for good measure, not to mention Qualcomm, Oracle, and Cisco. And the companies I just named, they're all basically monopolies in the Rockefeller sense. They all have these enormous monopoly gushers online. They are all among the largest companies in the world today. In terms of market value, 13 of the 30 most valuable companies in the world today are internet monopolies, 13 of the 30. And to give some sense to put that in perspective, and I looked at this data a couple weeks ago, and it changes. Only two of the 30 largest companies in the American economy today, in terms of market value, are too big to fail banks. So we always know how powerful the banks are and how much influence they have over our politicians and our economy. Well, the internet companies absolutely dominate compared to them even. So what we have are these massive monopolies where competition doesn't exist, and they're really carving up the internet as a commercial fiefdom among themselves. It's astonishing.
Mm-hmm. So what that does to journalistic operations, I mean, for example, we don't have a choice of many different cell phone providers, and the costs have been driven up, the kinds of speed and service, availability of service, all the rest of it is, determined by just having one or two or three that can offer some competition. So we've seen, I think, with cell phone service, how, or even with cable service and internet service, internet access, how limited that can be when you just have one or two suppliers, and they're basically doing the same thing. Where I live in Brooklyn, New York, for example, we could get Verizon DSL or we could get Time Warner Cable, but if you get Verizon, basically they use the Time Warner Cable, and the Time Warner Cable, for example, isn't even responsible for repairing the infrastructures they use. So, you know, with that, it's there's this tremendous freedom, but your actual provider, actually, there's very slim choice, very high fees. They kind of choose where they will or will not be, and we don't have a lot of choice. But somehow, because of all the content that's currently on the web, there is the sense that there is a greater diversity of choice. How does this, you know, we have big outlets like AOL, like Huffington Post. How does this kind of monopoly affect journalism?
Wow, you packed a lot into that question. Let me unpack it a little bit to get to mm-hmm. all the crucial parts of it. Mm-hmm. First, I want to return to the last point about monopoly online. Just a couple of things to clarify that. Mm-hmm. When we talk about the growth of these sort of massive monopolies, the primary reason for that is that there's what's called network effects that people didn't anticipate with the internet. And by network effects, that means that the largest company based on a network, all the consumers tend to flock to the largest company because it can offer a far superior product. So if I wanted to do social media, if my choice is to go to Facebook or Joe Blow Book, if I go to Facebook, there's a billion other people I can interact with. If I go to Joe Blow Book, it's me and Joe Blow. So no one's going to go to Joe Blow Book. Everyone goes to Facebook. And that's why you get these monopolies. And the advantage of sort of geography doesn't help online, because Facebook could be based in Antarctica and it wouldn't really affect its operations on the internet. So that's why you get those monopolies. And then they use patent law and traditional economic barriers to entry to maintain and rigidify their monopoly power. The problem with this monopoly for democracy, and this is really the crucial point, is that the whole premise of liberal democracy, of a capitalist democracy, is that the power of the government is separate from the power of the economy, and the economic power is diffuse in competitive markets. It's not dominated by a handful of large firms. And when you have a handful of large firms dominating the private economy, it completely screws up the theory of capitalist democracy. Because then what you see, as we have in the United States, is a powerful corporate interest working cahoots with the government to advance their mutual interests. And the effect of governance, of self-governance, declines appreciably. And I think that's a pretty good characterization of how the United States works today. So it is a real political problem, not just an economic issue, when you see this rise of monopoly. Mm-hmm. Now, on your question about, let's go to talk about the internet service providers, the ISPs. This is a special branch of monopoly in the United States, and it's an extraordinary story. It's a story of extreme political corruption and massive ripoff of citizens. And for most Americans, what they don't realize is they pay far more for cell phones. They pay far more for broadband wireline access through a cable company than people do in almost any other country in Europe or Asia or the industrial world. and they get much worse service. We pay vastly more than people pay in Sweden or Norway or Germany, and our service is much crappier for cell phone and for wireline internet. And the reason that is that we have the most corrupt imaginable system for ISPs. We have a cartel. AT&T and Verizon dominate and basically control the cell phone market. And they no longer really are trying to compete with Comcast and the cable companies for wireline. They sort of split it up between them. And the cable companies get to do the wireline broadband access led by Comcast. And they have very little competition. So what's happened in the United States is that 15 years ago, or even a dozen years ago, we were by far in the top one, two, or three of every measure of internet penetration, bandwidth, speed. You know, we were at the front of the world. We were showing the world the way to go digital. And today, in the exact same measures, in virtually every one, we rank between 15 and 30, and we're falling. We have crappier service. It's more expensive. Our networks are dated. That's because these companies are making massive amounts of profits. They have no competitive pressure on them because they have a cartel. They really don't have to worry about it. Their prices are sky high, and they have nothing pushing them to invest and upgrade their networks or expand their networks out to rural areas or to poor people because the regulation is a joke. The regulators are largely under their thumb and work at the behest of the AT&Ts of the world. It's an extraordinary crisis. And when Americans, when they travel abroad and realize, gee, it doesn't have to be this way, you know, sometimes they're sort of dumbstruck. Why are we stuck with this clunker system that is really just these companies are parasites. They provide nothing of value. What they're really good at is buying off politicians, manipulating politicians, dominating regulators. And that's always been their business model. These have always been government-created monopolies. These have never been competitive firms like you hear about in textbooks. And they've perfected that skill, and now they've managed to use it to create a whole new century of vast super profitability going forward by dominating internet service provision in the United States.
Well, it's really astounding because what you're mentioning is true across the board in various industries. I mean, when you were describing the low numbers for, you know, the quality of internet service compared with the rest of the world, I was immediately thinking of my original field, healthcare, and the low numbers of healthcare rankings for positive outcome on health concerns in the United States.
On that point, if I can, Allison, because I'm glad you raised that, because in the book I mentioned this too. I think it's completely analogous to healthcare in the sense that, you know, President Obama, when he was candidate Obama, and then the first year of office, on a couple of occasions said, look, if we were starting a healthcare system from scratch, we would never have a private health insurance industry. That wouldn't make any sense. Because, in effect, he didn't say this, but what he suggested, implied, was they're basically parasites who aren't a productive player. But then he said, but they're so powerful politically, we can't get rid of them. I can't mess with them. I can't possibly defeat them. So we have to build our reforms around the private health insurance giants. And I think that's the exact same story with regard to this ISP, the cartel, the AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast. You know, in healthcare, we pay much more and have much worse service, and lots of people don't get any coverage at all. That's the exact same thing in healthcare, exact same thing as it is with internet access.
So, you know, within that context, then, it's sort of like what you're saying is, you know, we're the deck of the ship, the entire ship, is owned by someone else. And so within this context that you're describing, the idea of journalism, of media, of democratic reporting, and all the rest of it is just at the behest. Do you have the right to arrange your deck chair, and report in a democratic manner within, the context of this large ship on the deck of the Titanic, or don't you?
The way I'd put it, Allison, is that, you know, part of, and you got to this in your last question, part of the reason why people have difficulty grasping this is they can go online and do whatever they want.
Right.
If they enter a title in a search or a Google search, they're going to have 81,000 pages show up instantly. And they're saying, wow, the world is just filled with information on this subject. So it looks like they're living in, to any person, like you're living in an information blizzard. people also probably, I do, have, you know, 15, 20 sites that I spend almost all my time on, unless I'm searching for a specific thing and then I hunt around. But if I'm just going to go to sites without doing a search, I just go to the same sites over and over. And I'm pretty happy with those sites. I found sites I really like that have some good information, so that's why I go there. And so how can I complain with the problem with all this other stuff going on that I've been describing with the cartel and with all these monopolists? And there's a couple of huge problems, one of which is that even though it looks like an information blizzard, what it's masking is that in many respects we have an information desert. And the reason why it's a desert is that the Internet has contributed basically to killing off mechanisms to compensate people for producing journalism and culture. The Internet's not solely responsible for the collapse of journalism, of paying journalism, and of paid culture to some extent in America. It's not fully, but what it is responsible for is pretty much accelerating the process and making it permanent. What I mean by that is that starting in the 70s and 80s, the amount of resources per capita going to journalism in America across all media, newspapers, broadcasts, magazines, the works, began to decline, probably in the late 80s. And it's been in pretty sharp decline throughout the 90s into today. Now, when the Internet came along, it really accelerated that. It did so because people would go online and find information they wouldn't have to pay for it. And they could get all sorts of free stuff, and more importantly, advertisers, especially classified advertisers, could jump ship and use the Internet far more effectively than traditional media, newspapers. And so newspapers were in collapse, and we see today a situation where there's probably, compared to 25 years ago, I'd ballpark it, we probably have about 40% of the resources going to journalism we did per capita in the late 1980s. And no one knows for sure. There's different estimates. But from my work, I put it in that area. And it's falling by all accounts. It's not going up. And it's going to continue to fall. And this creates a huge problem. So you have a ton of stuff online. But if you look at the last election, for example, most election races in this country that once got some coverage 20, 30, 40 years ago got almost no coverage whatsoever. And the coverage that was given was so superficial as to be all but worthless. And those are the things that are easy to cover for news media. Those are the things, you know, they're supposed to cover. A lot of the affairs of government that goes on, like zoning laws that affect toxic dumps, all sorts of policies, get almost no coverage anymore. There's just hardly any journalism left. It's an absolute crisis, and the Internet has aggravated it. And this leads to one of the points I get at in the book. I think it's one of the most important points in the book, which is that it's not going to get any better. There's everything suggests that even though the cost of doing media plummet when you go online, you don't have to print stuff up, you don't have to have as expensive equipment, the revenue side is so disastrous for producing journalism, there's no way to see how you can actually come anywhere near having the sort of resources that a democratic society needs to have for paid working reporters and journalists and competing newsrooms. And the reason for this, and this is really the key point, is that advertising is fundamentally changed online. And it's only in the last 3 years that this has become clear. We now have what's called smart advertising. In the days of Don Draper and Mad Men and all that, that's in the history books. The days in which advertisers would buy an ad on a newspaper or a broadcast program or in a magazine or on a website, and then the medium that got the money for the advertising would use some of the money to pay for the content, to pay the journalists and pay the reporters. Those days are over. They're not coming back either. The reason is that online what happens is that the way advertising is placed increasingly is not to buy space or time or a slot in a website that does news, but rather it's done through networks. And so when a company wants to buy an ad, it goes to Microsoft or Google or AOL or Yahoo, or soon Facebook, and it will say, we want to get 1 million women 18 to 29 who might be interested in buying an automobile in the next 6 months and who live in the suburbs. And the Microsoft will then, or Google will simply then send out a million hits within a couple hours and find those women on whatever website they're on. It doesn't matter what website they're on. It won't have to find them at the New York Times website. It might find them at the Target website. It might find them at, you know, the Best Buy website or JCPenney's. It might find them at Amazon. But it will find them because the secret of the Internet now is rather than being an institution where you can be anonymous and where you can go around and mind your own business and no one knows what you're doing, everything you do online basically is known now by commercial interests. They know all they need to know about you. And they'll find you online whenever they want to sell you something. And because of that, advertising basically no longer subsidizes journalism online. It's just over. It doesn't subsidize anything. It simply goes directly into advertising. The amount that ends up in the hands of content producers is pennies on the dollar what it was in old media.
Yeah, I know. That's very interesting. So in other words, that whole model where then they they have the newsroom, they have the reporter, they have the foreign correspondent and all, that isn't being subsidized by this. You know, it's funny because I was looking at something on the New York Times today, and an ad showed up that just really shocked me, and it illustrates exactly what you're talking about, which is it was an ad to for me to go to an L.A. medical clinic and receive services in prolotherapy, which is a sort of arcane treatment where you can get shots into your joints to that is a kind of alternative therapy that I had just been doing a long form article on. And so I have been researching it online, of course. And lo and behold, I'm on the New York Times and I'm being pushed an ad for prolotherapy services because they had figured out that I was interested in prolotherapy and figured that I was a likely, client for this company. So I think I think that illustrates what you're talking about.
Oh, absolutely. I think if people start taking a look, they probably notice that too and said, that's odd that I'm getting that ad. I think it's the shape of things to come. When I was doing this book, funny enough, I'm a sports fan. Sometimes I go online, I'll go to a sports website, and I just want to kill some time and relax. And I go to a sports that I go to all the time that does basketball, and there's ads for my book, Digital Disconnect, before it's even in print. I'm getting an ad following me. My initial response was, my publisher is amazing. They're must be buying ads everywhere in the world. Then I realized, no, this is what I'm writing about. I'm the only person on this website who's getting this ad. This is an ad just for me.
Oh, God. And so because of that, one of the this people do not realize at all what goes on backstage, at the desperate outlets that are still doing news content of some kind or other, and not that every single one of them is like this, but I just have to cite the quote that you quote in your book because it's so hard to describe this to people that aren't aware of this and, that aren't in the media and aren't aware of it. And it comes from an L.A. Times reporter, Tom Rutten, who you quote in your book, who was writing at the time of the AOL buy of the Huffington Post, my alma mater. And he writes, to grasp the Huffington Post business model, picture a galley rolled by slaves and commanded by pirates. can you interpret a little bit, when people hear this, they don't have a clue what it's about, but can you interpret this a little bit for people not familiar with what's going on backstage at all these outlets and the kind of the journalistic atmosphere there, so to speak?
If someone were to go into a newsroom in most American cities today, and it'd be a newspaper or broadcast news, it's like going into a morgue. It's like going into a country that just experienced plague that wiped out two-thirds of the population. And there's just tremendous, the resources are plummeting. The business community is wisely, or not wisely, but is determined accurately that there's no money in actual journalism. So they're reducing the resources dramatically, which is a vicious cycle because then people get a crappier product. They're less likely to want to read something. They have fewer reporters. And what this means is that there's an incredible downward pressure in wages for journalists. And for young people trying to break into the field or people trying to stay in the field have been in it for a long time, they're finding that there are far fewer jobs. Since there are so many more people who need work, businesses can pay vastly lower wages than would have been the case in the past. It's a deeply demoralized and dispirited institution, journalism today. I write about this a lot. I don't think we can survive without a journalism. I don't think this is an option. I don't think it's like you know, I don't think journalism is the equivalent of whether or not you have video rental stores. I think we can survive as a country without video rental stores. We can't survive if we don't have someone covering public life and drawing people into it, and doing so in such a way that empowers people rather than propagandizes them. It's just absolutely foundational to democratic theory. And this is the great existential crisis we face online. I have a whole chapter, as you know, in the book, in chapter 6 that you were quoting from, which tries to deal with this and deal with what's happening online, and trying to explain that it is a public problem. It's a political problem. This is not going to be solved by the technology. If we wait around and say, well, the technology that killed the internet or killed journalism or assisted in killing it is going to magically recreate some brand new, better journalism, I think that's just wishful thinking. There's no evidence to support that. If we want to have great journalism, we're going to have to understand it's a public good and come up with ways to funnel money into it to support it so we can have paid reporters and competing independent newsrooms covering our world.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk more about that in the second half of the show. We're going to go into a break here for station identification. Stay with us, listeners, on Connect the Dots. I'm speaking with Bob McChesney, the author of Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. Stay tuned for the second half of the show. Welcome back to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every week at Wednesdays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Today we're talking about the media, the Internet, the hopes for the Internet, and the reality of the Internet as a business model in terms of how well it's going to help us or repress us in sustaining democracy. I'm speaking with Robert W. McChesney, distinguished professor, media analyst, author of many books. His current book, Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy, is published by Free Press, and it's just out this month. A must read. Just want to say, give a few of the back cover quotes, which are quite impressive and distinguished. Here's what Bill Moyers has to say. If Thomas Paine were around, he would have written this book. If Paul Revere were here, he would have spread the word. So, getting back to what we were talking about in the first half of the show, and if you are just tuning in now and missed the first half of the show, please go to the Connect the Dot archives where you can listen to the whole show and also like us on iTunes. Also, if you've been enjoying the show, please share it with your friends so that others can benefit from Bob McChesney's wisdom. In the first half of the show, we were just talking about what the background of what sort of goes for internet reporting is, and I kind of read a quote that's in your book about that. What people don't realize, for example, I don't think I really fully grasped it myself, even though I am in the media and all of that and have been for some time, until I really began looking a little bit deeper. One of the things that you and John Nichols said in your earlier book is that there's not a lot of original content created when reporters are left off, and you know, we have this whole new media environment that we're living in. So there are many stories, as you mentioned in the first part of the show, that go uncovered. But what tends to happen, and one knows this through job hunting in this marketplace, as I have done, is that there's a lot of repurposing. So, you know, a story starts here, then it goes there, the headline is changed, a portion of it is taken. So it's almost like you're whittling away at a little wooden sculpture, and the amount of original content, it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And when we refer to the galley slaves who were frantically rowing, these are usually, you know, young people, recent college grads, who are just taking kind of any form of content that already pre-exists and, you know, kind of putting a green ribbon on it and pushing it out there again. So, in fact, it looks like a lot of content, but it's thinner and thinner content. It's more repeated content. It isn't original content. It isn't in-depth content. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I can, and Allison, I have bad news for you. It's even worse than you just described. And the reason why it's worse is that if it's not like as the journalism resources decline, you just have fewer news outlets or news programs, there's still stuff called news out there. CNN, Fox, MSNBC, local news on your TV still exists, if only to have advertising on it. But there's very little reporting going on. There's very little original work going on. So what do they use instead? Well, unfortunately, a lot of what passes for journalism today is what is called public relations. And there's an outstanding organization I urge listeners to look for online called the Pew Center that does research on news, and they just issued their most recent annual report. They do an annual report of the state of the news media every year, and it's first-rate research. And I use it all the time. I feel like I should give them a royalty check almost. They've been so valuable for me. But one of the studies they did a couple of years ago is they looked at the sources of news stories, how original they were and what the basis of the news stories were. And what they found is that the vast majority of what is for news stories in the community are not original reporting. They're just like you said, they're recycling what someone else did. They're not really adding any value. And what they also found is that of the original news stories, the ones that really had new stuff in them, over 80% of the stories basically were just regurgitating what someone in power said uncritically or just publishing a press release, some sort of public relations. It gave the illusion of being journalism, but it's really, you know, just uncritical passage of what someone in power wants you to think about. It's not really what we consider great journalism in democratic theory.
So you're just, in that case, we have the kind of situation where the press becomes a mouthpiece for the authorities, and whereas the press is the traditional role, the safeguard offered by the press traditionally was to be a critique.
And it's a function of what's taking place because, you know, from my research I've done looking at government employment data, in 1960 there was about a little less than one PR person for every working journalist. Today there are four PR people for every working journalist, four people trying to influence the news surreptitiously for everyone trying to report it. And so there's still a lot of news out there. If you go to the Yahoo headlines, if you go to pick up a news service, not much news, but there is what news there is, and broadcast news or cable news, it seems like there's a lot of news being covered, but a lot of it simply is that there are overworked journalists who aren't getting paid a lot in many cases, have a lot of pressure on them, and they just recycling a lot of new PR reports or just taking uncritical, sort of accepting the quote of a politician in power. And we've degenerated to such a point that good journalism is you get a quote from someone in power and you walk across the aisle and get a comment on it by someone on the other side of the aisle, and that makes someone a good journalist. Well, that's not journalism. That's stenography.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's really not sufficient just to say President Obama said this and Mitch McConnell said he's wrong. Now you decide. You figure it out. That's not journalism. That's stenography.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we noticed this a great deal in the coverage of fracking because that's been an area where I did a lot of pioneering coverage and have followed that for the last 3 or 4 years. And one of the things that was so annoying and frustrating in raising the profile of this issue, which I think, that's been happening, which is great, which is gratifying. It hasn't stopped it altogether, but a lot more people are aware of the problems than associated with this than ever before. But in the early years, what was happening all the time was that it was like, you know, people in the vicinity are experiencing water problems, health problems, you know, these various problems. But industry says it's safe. And that was the kind of the tit for tat that you're describing. You know, on the one side are, you know, these problems. And in the middle, where there should be government doing studies, doing tests, having regulation, that was like absent. And instead it was people, little local people who, you know, lived in various places where these companies had come in trying to, you know, faced off in the news with some, you know, an assertion from the company, it's safe, it's safe, we know it's safe. They weren't required to prove it was safe. And somehow their opinion, their wish that it was safe, their marketing need to say that it was safe, was regarded as you know, the second half of the news story. And there was no rebuttal, pushback, investigation of the assertion that it had been, you know, used safely for 100 years, which was a standard assertion. And yet it hadn't been. It was a relatively new, recent version of something that had been used 100 years ago, and there wasn't even anyone there to say, well, no, wait a minute, you know, you only really began this in 2004 with all these chemicals, et cetera. So that, to me, was just so striking and is an example of what you're talking about.
You're right, Allison. And in fact, this is a great crisis. And this is one we were told 20 years ago. This is exactly the sort of thing the Internet was supposed to make impossible. The Internet would be able to expose these sort of charlatans. That was the theory in 1993 or 1995, that you couldn't get away with BS and the truth would win out just by being on the Internet somewhere. And what we see with tracking is a great example, but I think it really any issue that deals with science that involves corporate power, where corporations have a lot of money on having bogus science, I think we've seen that journalism has not been able to get the truth out. It's just almost become, regrettably, an iron law. And part of the reason is there are a lot of reasons for this. I don't want to be vulgar and simplify it, but there's a couple things worth pointing out. One is that there was, two decades ago, the position of science journalist was a standard position in any self-respecting newspaper. Oftentimes they'd have more than one at a major paper, and in broadcast media. So there were actually people who knew a little bit about science, who would cover stories related to science, who would be able to interrogate claims and know when they were getting fed a pile of bull. Well, science journalism was one of the first jobs corporations said has got to go when they were making their first round of cuts in the 90s and the zeros. And there are very, very few qualified paid science journalists left in American journalism. So stories about fracking or more as important or related to it, global warming and climate change, are becoming political stories. And so you have political journalists who really don't know science, basically trained to report both sides of a debate, and they're getting a very sophisticated public relations surge campaign with a lot of money behind it coming from powerful interests who know how to package stuff to make it look legitimate. And what we've seen with climate change coverage, and I think it's true of fracking too, they're related, is simply that the general public gets the sense that the science is sort of split on the two.
Right.
That it's not really clear what's going on here, that we have to learn more, that there are extremists on both sides, that there's just a lot of ideology here. It's just not, but it's certainly not settled. And that's not the case at all. I mean, in climate change, it's just absolutely preposterous. It's like debating gravity at this point among the scientific community. But the power and wealth of the energy companies that bankroll these campaigns to prevent any effective policies to attack climate change is such that they've created mass confusion, and our journalism has played right along, eating right out of their hands. It's one of the darkest moments of modern journalism, and I'm not talking about some podunk journalism. I'm talking about right at the top. The New York Times is the worst offender of them all.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there has been a lot of alternative media on the internet that has raised the cry among a segment of the population. And I think that has been fruitful because that segment wasn't even well informed on these issues. So, but you know, I'd love to hear your the fact, for example, that this assertion of safety or the assertion of 100 years of energy independence, which is completely belied by levels of gas output, that's even in the mouth of the president. So it's like one has to keep reasserting and reteaching the same point over and over, about the safety claim, for example, where it's very difficult to gain traction in the face of all this. So it's not like we can't say it. No one's stopping us from saying it. It's said over and over. But it has to be said again and again and again, and it doesn't gain traction somehow because of the forces that you're describing. Now, I'd like to also zero in, since we're talking environment, about the closing of the environmental desk on the New York Times. When that happened, they said, here we are in the era of climate change, fracking happening in the state that this newspaper is published, nuclear issues with a major event in the last 2 years, that has reference to all kinds of nuclear reactors in this country as well, and the New York Times closes its environmental desk. Love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, it is, I think, unfortunately, par for the course. They were probably the last environmental desk in commercial journalism, if I'm not mistaken, or any journalism to speak of the mainstream media. And, this is par for the course. I mean, the commercial interests are cutting back dramatically. It's not a viable going concern to do journalism for the most part, and that's going to be one of the jobs that gets cut along the way. I think the the way out is really what we should talk about too, which is this isn't acceptable. And, you know, if we're going to deal with the great problems before this country, the environmental problems that are staggering, the social problems that are staggering, the economic problems that, you know, we have a generation of young people who face an economy that if you're looking for a job in 19, and you're in your early 20s today, it's not much of an economy. I doubt it's that much better than it looked like in 1933 if you were a young person looking for a job. And the problem is we don't have a news media that's doing anything, or a media system more broadly, to get people effectively engaged with issues, understand them, and participate in understanding policies that can change them. I think we've got to face up to the fact that the current commercial system is a failure. It's had problems all along, but now it's disintegrating. Regrettably, there's a strong tendency among Americans to sort of think, well, we'll just have to let the free market and the technology cook up a new cocktail for news media, and then we'll live happily ever after, because that's how we do it in America. Unfortunately, that's bogus. That's not how we do it in America. The first 100 years of American history, we instituted massive press subsidies on the understanding that if you left it just to commercial interests, you would not have had a popular journalism at all. You would have only had a journalism that would have served the elite, that would have served the owners of society and no one else, and you can't have a functioning democracy like that. And today we've got to face up to the fact that newsrooms are disintegrating. We don't have people covering stories. Most stories aren't getting covered now. We don't have competing independent newsrooms. The competition is very important in journalism. The evidence is really clear. If you've only got one newsroom covering a story, no one else, they're going to get lax. They're not going to be pushed. It's great when you've got two, three, four newsrooms covering a story, because then if someone misses it, someone else gets it, and everyone's held accountable to be on top of stories. We have nothing like that going on. Everything's going in the wrong direction right now. And when I talk about newsrooms, I mean people getting paid, not people who work a day job, have put their kids to bed, clean the house, pay the bills, then at 11 o'clock sit down and try to write down some sort of journalism on North Korean nuclear policy. I mean, people who get paid, do it for a living, are accountable for it, are competing with other people to do good work. That's what a real free press looks like, and that's what we have to have. And if we're going to have it, I think, Allison, it's a commitment of public resources. Market has voted. You know, advertising's not there. Advertising provided between 50 and 100% of the revenues for all journalism for the last 125 years in the United States, depending on the medium. And it's on the verge of going down to a lot closer to 10, 20, or 0%. And the more digital we get, the closer zero gets. And we're going to replace that money. And that's the key. And we're going to have to probably look where our founders and the framers looked. Before advertising came on to provide all that money, we did it with postal subsidies and printing subsidies that created the greatest press system in the world. We need to think creatively about how we can support and get paid for people doing journalism that are independent, not controlled by the government, but also that can just do great work and aren't beholden to commercial interests either.
How do you know? I understand what you're saying, and in fact, it makes tremendous sense when you think about it. And this is what you propose in your book, Digital Disconnect. But you know, the thing, and in fact, you know, when you think we're subsidizing nuclear power, we're subsidizing corn, you know, agriculture, and you know, and as kind of they can't do it without our help in this investment of money and infrastructure. You know, so in a sense, it makes complete sense. Why wouldn't we be subsidizing things that are public good, like a free press, for example? At the same time, the likelihood of it's happening, the path towards it's happening, in the face of all these other things that are happening, seems very unclear. What is your perspective on that aspect of it?
Well, yeah, I think it is unclear because it's, you know, we've been raised for 100 years to think that commercial interests making money is how you have a free press. And if they, and if the government plays any role whatsoever, it's the first opening the door to a Hitler, a Stalin, a Pol Pot. The worst possible outcome happens with censorship. And I think it plays on a very legitimate concern about government involvement. So that's all well and good. The problem with that whole theory, though, is it's not accurate historically. I mean, today, this, for example, just today I got from The Economist magazine their annual democracy index, where they list their ranking of all the countries in the world about how democratic they are using traditional political science criteria. one of which is the quality of the press system. And the United States ranks 21st, pretty far down the list when you think about it, in the Economist rankings. And I think it's a generous ranking when I looked at how they broke it down, but 21st. But if you look at the top five or six countries in the world, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Iceland, Finland, they all spend per capita 50 to 100 times more than we do to subsidize journalism with public money through massive public broadcasting, through support for independent media. They make it a high priority to invest in independent media. And these countries don't have censorship. They don't have darkness at noon. They don't have anyone locked up in the middle of the night. You can have public support for independent media without having Stalin or Hitler. In democratic societies, it's done all the time. In fact, it's mandatory. And we've got to take a page. We pay far less per capita to support independent media than any other democracy. It's not even close. And we've just got to wake up and say, okay, we were the ones that came up with the idea of supporting independent media with postal subsidies and showed it to the world. We've got to go back to our own history and somehow come up with ways to support journalism so people can make a living doing that in competing independent newsrooms. And the market's not going to give it to us. That much is now clear. And we just got to abuse ourselves of that notion and understand that this is much more like education. This is a fundamental public good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, what happens to us if we continue along this path that we're on now, if we don't do that? I mean, does media reform champion that? Is that one of the things that your organization, Media Reform, is up to, where people could go there and,
Mm-hmm. Well, Free Press, which is the group that I started with John Nichols a decade ago and just had its sixth National Conference of Media Reform in Denver a couple weeks ago with a couple thousand people, you know, is all about trying to rejuvenate journalism, increase funding for public and community media, and try to come up with creative policies so that people who want to go online and just do journalism can have ways to support themselves and have effectiveness and power so they can build up an audience and find be successful. So we can actually have people doing journalism in America. That's a crucial part of the job. And I think it's a central public issue. And I'm optimistic that we can win this battle eventually, largely because every other option has stepped backwards so decisively. I think Americans, especially American opinion leaders and intellectuals and journalists, have all wanted to find any other solution except public subsidies. They've tried everything. And right now, we really have run out of gas. Nothing is really working. If we're going to have journalism, the debate isn't whether we're going to have public subsidies, it's how we can have them to prevent the bad stuff, government censorship, government control, cronyism, or using the public funds so it bankrolls commercial interests, which I don't think would be acceptable. But these are the issues we should be debating, how to craft this to have an effective system. We should be studying what other democracies have done. They're ranked so much higher by the Economist magazine, no less, a Thatcher publication or a Reagan publication, that ranks us so low compared to the social democracies of Northern Europe. We need to be open-minded, but we're in a crisis. Now, this gets back to the point that we've been talking about for the second half of the show. We're in a situation now where the effective control over the politics of this country, by the people of this country, is, I think, probably weaker today than at any time in my lifetime. And it's growing weaker by the minute. You know, we have what my friend John Nichols called zombie ideas, ideas that voters routinely reject in elections, like getting rid of Social Security or privatizing it, privatizing public schools. All these ideas people don't like, but even when they elect candidates that sort of win on the platform that they like, these ideas keep coming back, and they keep coming back because there are powerful interests behind them. I think the environment's another case like that. Mm-hmm. And we have to basically find a media system that makes it possible so the informed will of the people becomes the governance of the country. That's what democracy is. And we're moving away from that. Nothing happening right now is getting us back to that. Now, of course, the Internet is not all negative, and it has many positive things. I live on it for the most part. And during moments of upheaval, the effect of social media is spectacular. The ability to organize people, to bypass censors, not just in the Middle East, but in the United States. There's tremendous value to it. But my point simply is that we need to have policies to keep it open, to make there be institution and funds there that actually do the good stuff, or we should be a concern that the way it's heading, with powerful interests guiding the ship, is in directions that are antithetical to what people think the Internet's all about.
So what you're basically saying is we either do a shift where we really take strong action to preserve journalism and an open internet, that a non-monopolized internet, that to promote democracy, or we really are paying the price very severely in terms of the downfall of democracy. If we fail to do that, you're saying that media is a leverage point for that change.
Or internet's a leverage point for that change. Yes, and I think if you study democracy, and I talk about this in the book, there are really four basic problems that can undermine democracy traditionally, historically, and this is true in virtually every country of the world, and it's true in the United States. One is too much inequality, another is too much economic monopoly. A third is too much a lack of an autonomous culture, too much commercialism. And the fourth is the great granddaddy of them all, too much militarism and empire and permanent warfare. All of these things in excess make it impossible to have effective self-governance. And the promise of the Internet that it was in each of those four cases was going to be a force for democracy. It was going to promote equality. It was going to smash monopoly. It was going to be this vast non-commercial space of culture that gives a flowering culture. And it was going to make imperialism, militarism, propaganda far less problematic. We'd no longer go to unjust, wars for no reason, just so military contractors could get rich. And unfortunately, in each of those four areas, the Internet, has not been able to just magically turn the tide. And each of those four areas, matters have grown worse in the last 15 years, not better. And so if we're concerned about democracy, we have to address each of those four issues. We've got to grab the steering wheel and have the Internet and our broader communication system be part of the solution, not part of the problem.
Very, very, very interesting. Very terrific. Thank you so much. We're coming into the end of our hour here with you, Professor Robert McChesney, author of Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. This is a new book out from Free Press. Go online and get it, everyone. Thank you so much for being with me today, Bob, on the show again, and good luck with the book. It really is brilliant and deserves a wide, wide read. And thank you, listeners.
Thank you so much, Allison.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, listeners, for being with us today and Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy, wishing you a great week.